This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So the last time I was here, I guess you could say we created a context for this talk in the sense that we talked about the preceding factor in the Eightfold Path, that of right view. Right view, basically, to summarize that teaching, I think the way that I like to frame it is that it begins with the teachings on cause and effect or causality, and I talked at length about that. But in a nutshell, causality or cause and effect or dependent co-arising is the idea that nothing that exists does so independent of its causes. Or that everything that we can be aware of or experience is available to us to be experienced only because of the causes or conditions that bring it into being. So that for everything that we can experience, there's a relationship between it and its causes. Does this make sense? I always like to point out these human bodies, for example, are here because our parents got together. There's a causes and conditions for the appearance of this form, and that they don't exist any other way. The same is true of our emotional experiences. The same is true of our thoughts. My experience is that our thoughts are largely associations of the mind. I like to tell the story about sitting in retreat and kind of contemplating the mind and the origin of thinking. And I remember there being a sort of light behind my eyes and sort of seeing that that looked like a star, and that the star reminded me of Paul Stanley from Kiss. And then that made me think of Detroit Rock City, which is a song that Kiss always opened with. And because I was thinking about Detroit, the next association was Detroit the city, and then Michael Moore, who made all these movies about Detroit, and then which made me think of Bowling for Columbine, which made me think of that cantankerous actor that was like an NRA. He just died of a year ago. Heston, you know, and it's like, and so over and over again, and I sat with this for weeks of just sort of like, where do thoughts come from? I just noticed that there was a cause and effect relationship. You could trace them back, boom, boom, boom. Each one of them in association arising out of a set of conditions in the mind or in the environment. That even the squeak of a chair would be like, oh, that's the key of that country song I used to listen to. Like, it would just like... So, point being that this is for you to investigate, but my experience is that this is true. That everything that exists, we can see that there's some cause or condition that precedes it. Now, this is important because I believe that all of the rest of the Dharma can be understood through this concept. It's how we understand the mechanics of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are like sort of we describe the mechanics of how self-generated suffering arises. So, the standard way of talking about that is the First Noble Truth is the truth that of dukkha or of suffering, and that suffering has a cause, which is craving. There's a cause and effect relationship right there. So if we undermine craving, we overcome the self-generated suffering. That's why it's important, because we start to see like, oh, if we remove the causes, then the thing that we experience goes away too. And that's the whole insight. Same is true of the teaching of karma. Karma is just a teaching about the results of our actions. That our actions bring results, and that the results of our actions can either be harm and suffering and a lack of ease, or it can be ease and well-being and balance and non-harm. That there's a cause and effect relationship between our intention and our behavior and the results. The Eightfold Path, as it's laid out, is also can also be seen that way, actually. And this is where we start to understand that right view is a condition for right intention or right thought. That there's a relationship between them. Now, because of the central teaching in right view is the view on the Four Noble Truths, which asks us, as I outlined last time I was here, asks us to fully know and turn towards what is difficult. Turn towards and fully know birth, aging, sickness, death. To fully turn towards not getting everything that we want, that our desires aren't always met. That sometimes we get what we want, but we lose it. It's impermanent. Impermanence has its way of separating us from what we hold dear. And that just the facts of life, our day-to-day experience, requires us to confront or contend with that which is unpleasant. This is the first noble truth. The basic teaching is that is the prompt is for us to look at that and to fully know it. There's a point in at the end of that teaching of the Four Noble Truths where the Buddha says, had I not awakened, or had I not fully known these Four Noble Truths, I would not claim to have an awakening. He says a peerless awakening, and you know. So this is important because to me that's a description then of what awakening actually means. When we say, this is the path of awakening. Well, awakening to what? Awakening to these Four Noble Truths. Had I not awakened to these Four Noble Truths, I would not claim to have had to be enlightened, to be awakened. So it's a pointing us towards like, oh, okay, so this is what we're awakening to. And part of what we awaken to is dukkha. And so we turn towards it. The prompt is to fully know what is unpleasant, to fully know birth, aging, sickness, and death, having our desires not met. I teach on this all the time. I say it frequently. I'll say it until you get it. When you turn towards birth and aging and sickness and death, when you turn towards the fact that we don't get everything that we want, that we're separated from those we love, what I think arises organically out of that is compassion. There's like a symphony of weird noises now. So compassion arises out of the experience of actually, I think that compassion, I mean, there's two ways that we develop it in Buddhism. One is that we can develop it proactively, and we do that through things like the metta phrases and the metta practice and the practice of compassion and all of that. There's a proactive way that we do it. But I think that quite organically it arises when we start to include in our lives what is difficult. I think it's enough just to, I mean, I say this quite a bit, but I think it's enough just to realize, like, for me, like, just the fact that we're on a planet that's hanging in the middle of space, and that, like, it's dark outside because the Earth just tilted away from the sun, and we're, like, stuck to the side, you know, and that everybody has to die, like, that's enough for compassion for me right there. Like, when you really consider, like, what the fuck are we doing? Like, what is this? Like, I'm not supposed to eat ice cream in out of relationship to that truth, you know? Like, that's a trip. So when we really look at life, what arises organically for me is a caring, a compassion. When you recognize and you look around this room that, you know, that all of that stuff that I just said is true for everybody in this room, that each of us will be separated ultimately from the people that we hold most dear, and that all of us want happiness and not to suffer, and that we're all trying to manipulate the conditions of our lives so that we just have some ease, then compassion is what organically arises out of it. And so does, actually, friendliness and loving kindness. Because when you... Have you ever had an experience with somebody where, like, it may be a partner or something, and you're fighting with them, and maybe there's a heated argument, and you're just really kind of gelled into your positions, and you're not getting anywhere, and there's, you know, you're being harsh with them or something, and then they, like, break down, and then, like, the movement of the heart is just to go, like, oh, my God, like, are you, you know, like, all of a sudden, you see their suffering in a really clear way. And what happens is, like, very frequently is there's sort of, you sort of lose that kind of, and you're all, you move directly into, like, sort of kindness. It's just sort of like our nature, I think. When we see that there are certain things, certain ways of thinking, certain behaviors that lead to harm and lead to suffering, and we start to be able to see the cause and effect relationship between certain behaviors, certain thoughts, certain types of speech, certain actions, and their results, that they bring a lack of ease or suffering, or they cause harm, then the movement, the natural organic movement of the study of the mechanics of the first noble, the Four Noble Truths in the first, in under right view, in that first fold in the path, what naturally arises is a movement towards letting go of what it is that causes harm and suffering. So then we see how the study of right view, of cause and effect, of karma, the cause and effect relationship between behavior and its results, that we look at, study the mechanics of suffering outlined in the Four Noble Truths, we see how the right intentions arise quite organically out of that experience. So right intention is three things. The intention towards compassion, non-cruelty. The intention of loving kindness or friendliness. The intention towards renunciation. So these are the basic three aspects of right thought or right intention. There's a, I don't know what he is actually. Rupert Sheldrake was, I think, a sort of psychologist or something. And he had a theory called, what's that? And he's still alive, so he's not a was. I just remember this from, like, high school, I think. But he had this theory called morphic resonance, which basically says that the more that we... That he's talking about species, but the more that we do a certain kind of behavior, the more that we can expect that that will be the inclination of our habit. And there's just a sort of, it's like a, there's a momentum around habits or around behavior. But the more we do something, the more that that's our response to life, the more we can expect that to be our response. And so then we start to see, like, the wisdom of, oh, okay, so this is why we proactively cultivate loving kindness and why we proactively cultivate compassion. Like, we actually will carve out time or entire retreats to cultivate proactively these kind of mind states of caring about suffering, of the generosity of meeting everybody that we meet, the ideal mother would meet her only child. Now, since our thoughts in the chain of cause and effect that leads to the results that are either happiness or an ease or harm and suffering, since our thoughts condition our actions and our actions bring results, then it's important that we begin to get a handle on what our thoughts and intentions are. Because they condition behavior, and behavior conditions results. And those results either harm, and you get it. So this, I just find that this idea of cause and effect is so prominently displayed when we start to look at our lives and study them through mindfulness. Now, in the beginning here, we did a little bit of a sort of study of like, okay, what actually is a thought? So for us to begin to get our, to wrap our heads around, well, what are these thoughts and intentions that actually run our lives and are the core place that we're to begin to look to see, to get some clues about what the results might actually be so that we can have some agency in creating our reality, then we want to know, part of this is a study of like, what is thought? So that's why we spent some time tonight looking at like, well, what are our thoughts composed of? Well, they're composed of words and images primarily. And can we develop some level of intimacy in relationship to them? And the last time I was here, I talked about being in abstinence from sugar. It's a practice that I do. And I do it because of the results, because I end up feeling like I'm hit by a truck. Typically when I eat sugar, it has an addictive quality for me. I simply don't feel good. So because of the results, it has become filed away for me as an unwholesome behavior, or one that leads to a lack of ease, a lack of well-being, harm, suffering. Now, what we find when we start to get into a conversation about renunciation or letting go of behaviors is how difficult it is actually to let them go. Now, has anyone ever let anything go? Have you had this experience?
Yes.
Was it easy?
No.
Sometimes. If we can get a handle, what I have found that's really amazing about renunciation, and quite useful, is that when we stop doing a thing, a behavior, when we take it out of, we kind of take it off the table, what happens is that what is available to us then is a study of the conditions that precede and inform the behavior. Because sometimes seeing that we want to stop something is pretty apparent to us. And by the way, I think that we stop a behavior for two reasons. And this is part of the work that I do. I work with people I work with a lot of people in recovery. I work with integrating mindfulness and the principles of Buddhism in work around wellness with people. And so day in and day out, I'm constantly having conversations about how to renounce behaviors that are, don't create balance or well-being. And my experience has been that basically we stop doing certain behaviors for two reasons. One is that a sort of cost-benefit analysis has leaned too much into cost. That the thing that we're doing is too painful. Does anyone have that experience? Like, it brings a certain level of pleasure. Like, drinking's kind of cool. It's pleasure and there's a numbing kind of effect to it. And it also results in a massive hangover or lots of other much worse things for some of us. So we set it aside because it causes more pain than the benefits. So it's a sort of cost-benefit analysis. It's like, well, there's some benefit, which is like, it numbs me out, I don't have to feel anything, it's kind of fun, maybe it even tastes good, I don't know. But the cost is too high. So we just sort of, we come to terms with that, like, I can't continue to do this because it's too painful. I've been sober for a number of years, and I when I reflect sometimes on how many days I spent in just pain, like hungover, it's amazing. I mean, there were thousands. Like, it pains me to say. at some point it kind of dawned on me that the cost is more is too much, and the benefit is not enough. When we talk about the other reason, two reasons. Before I go on, I have to tell you the other reason. Yes? Buddha? You forgot the other reason. The other reason is that people let things go is because they want something else more. And this is a big motivation in spiritual practice. When I decided to let go or renounce drugs and alcohol, my practice took off. And there's a reason why it's a precept. I mean, for those of you who don't know, there is this teaching on the five, we take five precepts when we begin our practice. And they're precepts, they come before we practice because they create the conditions that are most conducive to actually making some progress on this path. And so my experience has been that I practiced before and it was beneficial, but when I let that go, that there was this sort of just real shift. Now, one of my clients, maybe 2 weeks ago when I was talking to him, made this observation that is, to me, is like so obvious, but I never quite put it that way, and I was really excited to have someone frame it that way. When we talk about renunciation, we're talking about what we renounce is addiction, addictive-like behavior to sensual pleasure. That's one of the ways of looking at it. Another way of looking at it maybe is looking at what it is that puts us to sleep in a sort of sense. Because what my client said, he said, you know, addiction is like the exact opposite of fully knowing dukkha. It's like exactly the opposite. It's completely avoidant. It's totally numbing, it's totally avoidant, it's not at all creating the conditions to fully know what's uncomfortable about your life. They're incompatible experiences. So, the Buddha put it this way. Because I was there. But thus I have heard. In talking about how to deal with, like, how do you establish a criteria for letting something go? Because part of the message here is like, okay, so there's all this heavy language around sensual pleasure in Buddhism. You hear it is a hindrance. It is a fetter. It's one of the things that keeps us tethered to the round of rebirths or whatever, you know. It's one of the three types of desire that lead to suffering. In fact, the entire Eightfold Path, also known as the Middle Path, is middle because it's a path that goes between two extremes. That's how it gets its name. And the two extremes are over-renunciation, total self-denial, self-punishment, the kind of ascetic practices that were popular in India at the time, and the addiction to the pursuit and gratification of sensual pleasure. So actually being in that realm, being caught up in a kind of lost in the pursuit and the gratification of sensual pleasure is not being on the path. It's actually being caught in what he called a dead end. He even talked about it as a ghetto. Like it's off the path. So it's interesting then, so is the message that we're supposed to take like, okay, so sensual pleasure is bad, you know. So when he was talking about this, he put it this way, and I think it's important to share this. He says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me, and I understood thus. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from wisdom. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties and leads away from wisdom, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I then abandoned it, removed it, I did away with it. So I find this teaching important because what it does is it establishes a criteria for letting go. And the basic criteria is harm. If you cause harm to yourself or to others or to both, I always find that funny. Like he says all three of those things. That's pretty common. There's three realities. If it causes harm to yourself or to others, then you want to look at letting it go. If it obstructs your practice, if your deepest intentions for your life are to walk this path, to walk a middle path that is not this dead end of the constant pursuit and gratification and being lost in sensual pleasure, then you need to look at the ways that experience or that behavior, the behaviors in your life, obstruct your progress. This is obvious when in the teachings on the hindrances. The first of the five hindrances is the addiction to sensual, the pursuit and gratification of sensual pleasure. It's also, to me, obvious in the precepts, where I think the fifth precept, for those of you who know, asks us not to take intoxicants which cloud the mind, lead to heedlessness, it said. Heedlessness meaning just a lack of awareness or mindfulness or presence. I think that this can be said also of not just drugs and alcohol, but also food. And my experience has been that wheat and sugar and overeating are the main ways that happens. We should look at sex. Sex can be a completely avoidant experience. You can spend entire weekends masturbating and being online and trying to get laid. I know, I've done it. Really, I mean, it's complete. It can be completely a way that we do not fully know the difficulties of our lives. And if our awakening happens through that difficulty, through fully knowing dukkha, the very first teaching, then we want to be aware of the ways that we're constantly sidestepping our lives. And it can happen through all. I mean, you know the ways. I don't have to tell you. I guess I'm sort of running out of time. So how do we practice with this? So some of the places that we might want to look for renunciation in our own lives are television, cable, our smartphones. I don't know about you, but I can... How many apps do you have? And how much time do you spend with that? Technology and media in general. I know people who have done this really, I've never done it, but people will go and do what they call a media fast, where they will actually not watch the news or any kind of media at all. They don't read newspapers, they don't read magazines, they're not constantly being bombarded with all of the sort of political stuff that Neil is pointing at. And people have amazing results with it. And in fact, one woman I know had the experience of coming back into the media and just feeling like it was so incredibly painful. Like when you actually kind of become a human being again, and then you go back in and you're sort of like, whoa, this is really amazing. So looking at media, social media as well. I know you, Facebook, I'm looking for you. Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr. What's the picture one? Instagram. You know. If you have a hard time establishing a daily practice, how much time do you spend on Instagram? You know? Casual sex, huge, totally huge thing. been a big part of my practice to look at how to have a level of abstinence around the pursuit of sex. I don't know if you know it or not, but as a gay man, it's pretty easy to get nookie. In fact, there's a thing called, I don't know if you know, there's a thing called Grindr.
Yeah.
Does everybody know what Grindr is? Grindr is a thing, well, maybe I shouldn't tell you. Basically, it GPS tracks men for you.
What?
Like, it tells you, like, how far away they are. It's the best. No, it's, I mean, it's the worst thing that ever happened. But it can be, like, you know, people talk about it being the source of a new level of addiction. Like, it's insane, like, the way that it, you know. So looking at, you know, and so this is important too, because it's not actually always the gratification of a sensual pleasure that's the problem and brings results and all of that. It's actually the pursuit. It's wanting in and of itself, desire in and of itself. You can stay high on an experience. You know, you can tap into an internal pharmacy of all kinds of drugs just by, like, staying aroused to the pursuit of sex. And that's a numbing. And that's not fully knowing dukkha, fully turning towards your life. It's a total avoidance. So all I'm saying is, the message here is that sex is not bad. You can eat cookies, you know, like. But it's for us to really look at it and just looking at the criteria of, like, does it cause harm to myself, to others? Does it obstruct me from my practice? Is it something that, like, I know that there are people here in this room, and I'm one of them at times, where I think, man, I'm just like, how do I not find the time to sit? Like, I'm teaching this shit, and sometimes I don't find the time to sit, right? And then when I really look at my life, there are places in these categories of experience that if I just let them go or renounce them or set them to the side, that I find hours to meditate. Drugs, alcohol, consumerism. I would even say, like, part of the conversation here too is considering simplicity in your life. One of my favorite, beings, I guess, was a woman named Peace Pilgrim. Anybody ever? Nobody else. So there's a woman named Peace Pilgrim. Yeah. Who basically, in a response to, I guess it was the Vietnam War at the time, she decided to renounce all of her possessions. And what she did is she just walked back and forth across the United States with a little sign that said something like, walking for peace, or something, Peace Pilgrim walking. And on the side, on the back, it had, like, she had recorded how many miles. And she had let go of all of her possessions, and she never ate until somebody offered her food. She never slept inside, you know, in an establishment unless somebody offered it to her. And she wrote this book. Well, actually, it was transcribed from a set of interviews. But she talks about simplicity, and it's amazing. Like, she talks about how free, how if you feel like renunciation is deprivation, then you have no idea what you're talking about. It's actually freedom. She says, I feel like the freest person in the world. And she's like, and the funny thing is, people respect me so much that they keep trying to give me large sums of money. And she's like, and I don't want them. So Peace Pilgrim's an interesting read. All right. Let's end with a reflection. So just close your eyes. You don't have to do anything special. Reflecting on what are your deepest intentions for your life? What do you care about? What's important to you? What is it that stands in the way of doing some of those things or manifesting some of that stuff? What could you let go of that you could use your time better? What are your intentions around your spiritual pursuits? Around the development of compassion or mindfulness, around meditating? What stands in the way? What hinders your capacity? What is your relationship to the precepts around intoxicants? What are the ways that you numb yourself? Drugs, alcohol, food, sex? Social media, consumerism. What is it? How do you put yourself to sleep instead of being awake? What could you let go of that could be a compassionate act? You'd let go of it because it would benefit other beings, your family, your community. Can renunciation be an act of compassion? Maybe you've always wanted to be a vegan, and now's the time. And if you had just one thing that kind of rose to the top, what would that be? What is most calling out for you to look at, to tend to let go, to change your relationship to? What needs to be set aside? Maybe it stands in the way of your career or your relationship to your family. Maybe it has nothing to do with Buddhism. What would make you a happier, more balanced, more connected, more present person? And are you willing to do anything about it? And what are you waiting for? Maybe there's an intention forming out of this reflection. Maybe not. And this is your take-home gift for tonight.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.